Good morning, friends. So January has typically been Peace Month at North Valley. We've used this month to pay attention to our Quaker distinctive of being peacemakers and peacekeepers. And this honors our tradition and our conviction as friends. And as I was looking into this, I found this quote from a message that was sent to King Charles II in 1660. Our principle is, and our practices have always been, to seek peace and ensue it, and to follow after righteousness and the knowledge of God, seeking the good and welfare and doing which tends to the peace of all. I love how they said, our practice has always been, all 10 years of it, when they write this. But it feels a little more like now, centuries later, that our practice has always been. Or has tried to be. And it's worth mentioning that the early friends come into being, our faith tradition comes into the being, in the midst of the English Civil War, which is a hard time to be peacemakers. Particularly from religious grounds, as the Civil War itself is being fought over a religious ideology, at least as the veneer of this war. And saying God is against violence and war is a good way to get everybody to hate you. Which is pretty much what happens to the Quakers. But I wonder sometimes if part of the confusion around our peace testimony is that it becomes exclusively about being anti-war. And although early friends and later friends know firsthand the difficulties and abuses of war, the peace testimony does not simply come out of resistance to institutional violence or to the consequences of institutional violence, but out of a conviction that Christ calls us to another way. This also, from an older document from the Faith and Practice of Britain Yearly Meeting, it is the witness of early friends who did not draw a hard and fast distinction between the various Quaker testimonies, but saw them as a seamless expression of the universal spirit of Christ that dwells in the hearts of all. So we don't see peacemaking as some sort of political movement or some sort of disconnected part of who we are, but this is a central piece of who we're called to be as followers of Christ. And maybe sometimes we see peacemaking simply as the sort of overwhelming, global, interconnected dialogue, politics, violence, political thing. I don't know if you feel that way sometimes. And I don't want to suggest that Christ does not call us to some sort of change of making, you know, swords into plowshares. I think that is part of our call. But I think more importantly and more centrally, there's a sense of personal and interpersonal direction of Christ in our life that permeates this stuff. Let the peace of Christ that passes all understanding dwell within your hearts. Right? This idea of God's peace is not just about politics. This is about faithfulness to Christ and part of an inherent peace, an organic peace of who we're called to be as people who follow Jesus. Let's hear Jesus' words in Matthew 5, 38 through 48. Jesus says, here's another old saying that deserves a second look. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Is that going to get us anywhere? So here's what I propose. Don't hit back at all. If someone strikes you, stand there and take it. If someone drags you into court and sues you for the shirt off your back, gift wrap your best coat and make a present of it. And if someone takes unfair advantage of you, use the occasion to practice the servant life. No more tit-for-tat stuff. Live generously. You're familiar with the old written law, love your friend and its unwritten companion, hate your enemy. But I'm challenging that. I'm telling you to love your enemies. Let them bring out the best in you, not the worst. When someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer. For then you are working out of your true selves, your God-created selves. This is what God does. God gives us his best, the sun to warm and the rain to nourish, to everyone, regardless, the good and bad, the nice and nasty. And if all you do is love the lovable, do you expect a bonus? Anybody can do that. If you simply say hello to those who greet you, do you expect a medal? Any run-of-the-mill sinner does that. In a word, what I'm saying is, grow up. You're kingdom subjects. Now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously and graciously towards others, the way God lives towards you. And maybe you'll remember, this is Jesus' first sermon in Matthew. And I'm thinking, you know, man, take it easy. You want people to still listen to you, right? So how did we get here? Like, how do we move? You know, we just finished Christmas. How do we move from Christmas to this? You know, Jesus was just a baby, and now Jesus is preaching. And if we follow along in Matthew, starting in chapter 1 and moving through chapter 5, there's a lot of sort of flow here, which is good. You'd expect that stuff to connect. So in Matthew 1, you have the whole genealogy of Jesus. And so who was Jesus descended from? You guys remember that? There's the whole all the begats in that chapter. And this is Matthew's importance of saying this is a person who's meant to do this. Matthew's real big on that. He keeps on saying this through these chapters. This happened because, right? And so chapter 1 is these are the ancestry, so you know this is the right guy. Chapter 2, which we just spent a lot of time with in December when we think about Christmas and the Nativity, you have all these fulfilled there too. All these, this happened so this would be fulfilled. This happened so this would be fulfilled. This prophecy. And then you move into chapter 3 and you have more scripture being fulfilled through John's ministry. So a verse, the Isaiah verses, a voice calling in the wilderness. You have John, and it really caught me this time as I was prepping and thinking about this, that when Jesus comes to be baptized, John says, no, 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 no. Remember this? Jesus shows up and John goes, no, you got this backwards, Jesus, which in my experience seems to be a bad phrase to use. And Jesus said, no, this is important. And what caught me about this is that somehow what John was called to do was important, even in Jesus' case. And so there's an importance of our faithfulness that it matters what we're doing. This is important, what's happening. Then in chapter 4, Jesus is tempted. We remember this story. Jesus has been out fasting for 40 days and then is tempted in multiple ways and passes those tests, passes that temptation. And we move to chapter 5, which is the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, which is where we just heard the end of that chapter being read. And in this first sermon of Jesus, he seems really concerned with the idea of moving from religion as legalism, religion as towing the line, to relationship with God. That our relationship with God is about trust and about our willingness to put ourselves in places to be vulnerable with God and let God work through us. And what Jesus is trying to open us up to and open the disciples up to here is what happens when God is actually present. What helps us see things from God's perspective? And so we remember some of these things, right? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the, as remember, there's several, blessed are the meek. Blessed, you know, and the things that you often say, really? And we've spent time recently as a congregation working through these. And there's lots of commands about love and faithfulness, about being salt and light, about a new understanding of the law. Remember Jesus says here in Matthew, I didn't come to abolish the law. I came to fulfill it. And honestly, this is pretty difficult teaching. This is challenging teaching. It's easy to misuse, and this is the kind of teaching that I don't think you want to grab by the wrong side, right? Because if we see this as the new legalism that we can never have hate in our hearts, or it's as good as murder, or if my eye offends me, I pluck it out, or if my hand does something that's sinful, I cut it off, I'm not sure why all of us still have hands in this room. I don't think Jesus meant this literally. I think Jesus was trying to get us to change our perspective, to move from this way of seeing, can we do enough to get into my whole being is transformed and changed. Jesus is inviting us into a deeper reality of collaboration with God. to a new reality of deeper intimacy with God. Now, maybe you've noticed, maybe it's just the echo chamber on my Facebook page, but there's been a lot of talk lately about how we're supposed to be the church. What does it mean to become something new, renewed, different? How do we deal as the body of Christ with the multitude of issues that we're facing and that we're experiencing? And I guess I would contend that there's a lot of pretty straightforward advice right here in Matthew 5. Dallas Willard, in his book Divine Conspiracy, speaks a lot about the Sermon on the Mount, and he says this about our current 30 years ago situation. In many cases, our need to wonder about or be told what God wants in a certain situation is nothing short of a clear indication of how little we are engaged in God's work. Thanks, Dallas. That's encouraging. And yet I think there's some truth in that when we come to these places that we sort of wring our hands or gnash our teeth and say, what should we do? Well, maybe we should listen to what Jesus is telling us. And so when we relegate what Jesus is teaching in Matthew 5 as nice advice, but not something we can really accomplish, or something that really should take place in the diplomatic conversations of countries or in the resolutions of problems we see in the news or in our own lives, we end up building walls between ourselves and what God is doing and God's intention in the world. Hear these words of Jesus again. When someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer. For then you are working out of your true selves, your God-created selves. This is what God does. God gives us his best, the sun to warm and the rain to nourish. To everyone, regardless, the good and the bad, the nice and the nasty. And if all you do is love the lovable, do you expect a bonus? Anybody can do that. If you simply say hello to those who greet you, do you expect a medal? Any run-of-the-mill sinner does that. In a word, what I'm saying is, grow up. You're kingdom subjects, now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously and graciously towards others, the way God lives towards you. And to put it mildly, this doesn't seem to reflect the tone of our country right now and the nature of conflict we see around us or our political or social dialogue. And maybe it doesn't reflect the relationships we have in our families or community or faith communities. And I think our tendency in hearing this seems to be one of two things. Like our reaction, like either we're going to react in shame, like I can't believe that we're not doing this better. Or denial. No, this is going okay. Or we can't get there. This is too high of a standard that Jesus sets up. And our shame maybe comes into that we aren't living up to our calling. Our denial is that the calling of Christ is an unacceptable, inaccessible reality. But in both of these responses, we miss the core of what Christ is calling us to. Remember the beginning of Jesus' teaching in the Beatitudes, the beginning of this Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says this, very first thing, you're blessed when you're at the end of your rope. With less of you, there is more of God and God's rule. Jesus says it again a little bit differently in Luke, in a different part of Luke. If you grasp and cling to your life on your terms, you'll lose it. But if you let that life go, you'll get life on God's terms. And maybe the most helpful and direct way that Jesus teaches about this, we've already heard, when someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer, for then you're working out of your true selves, your God-created selves. Respond with the energies of prayer. That's not always my first response. I don't know if it's yours or not. But I think Often it seems like our first response in these situations is a response of self-defense, of care for the self, rather than trusting that God will care for us and that we can be faithful to trust that God will work the rest out. And we're resistant to this too. Like, if we do that, won't evil take over the world? Don't folks have to stand up for justice? Do we just roll over and let the wicked run the place? But those questions only come up if we're assuming that God doesn't care about resisting evil and injustice. If we're serious about bringing about God's kingdom, we have to be serious about trusting God to do that work and us following God's lead. We have to be willing to allow that to happen in us, that we trust God in our depths, which means relinquishing our own power over our own lives. So I have a magnet on my fridge, and it says, "Let go or be dragged." And when I first got this magnet, I thought it was just mostly funny. You know, I got a picture of a cowboy behind a horse trying to hold on, kind of thing. Or maybe some of you have gone water skiing before. Have you had this experience? Let go of the rope. It's hard to remember. But as I've sat with that magnet, you know, I see it every day because it's on my fridge. And as I've sat with it, it's become more helpful to me and maybe a little less funny. because I often carry a lot of stuff around with me that drags me around. I hold a lot of stuff, a lot of grudges, or I hold a lot of bad memories. Or I try to keep on holding on to things and saying, this can't change, and it does. And that drags me around. And so I think sometimes it's really good advice, I mean, sort of the core piece here, the first phrase, let go. I think that's good advice often. But as I got to thinking about it this week, I thought about this idea of it's a phrase we don't use much anymore, clinging to Jesus. Some of you maybe remember when that phrase was used a little more frequently. And I've wondered about that, about this. Maybe sometimes it's good to be dragged. That as I hold on to Jesus, I get dragged to all kinds of places that might not be where I would have chosen to go myself, but might well worth being dragged to. Jesus will take us on journeys that will challenge and transform us, and through us will challenge and transform the world. And I think the piece of this whole sermon that I read this week, I mean, this Sermon on the Mount that I didn't even finish, I only just read the first chapter of it, right? There's a lot more. That ends in chapter 5 with what we've already heard, but let's hear it again. In a word, what I'm saying is, grow up. You're kingdom subjects. Now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously and graciously towards others, the way God lives towards you. And I think our growing up and our being kingdom subjects hinges on this phrase, live out your God-created identity. Be that which God calls you to be. And there are hints here on what this should look like. Generosity, grace, love, care towards others. But at the root of that is God creating our identities and us living out of that center. So here's the call. Can we live out of this way of being? Not simply as peacemakers in our world, but peacemakers in our homes and at our work, in ourselves, in our faith communities. Are we willing to take this seriously and trust God enough to have lives that reflect this calling in Matthew 5? So let's take some time to listen. We believe Christ is present right here, right now. God is creating our God-created identities in us as we sit here. And maybe Christ has a message just for you this morning. We ask that you take that seriously. Or maybe Christ has a message for you for some other folks who aren't even here. We ask that you take that seriously too. And if Christ has a message through you for all of us, we ask that you would stand and a microphone will be brought so we can hear that message. We don't have queries this morning. I thought we might just sit with this from Jesus. Let's take some time to listen. Yeah.